Welcome to the Musician's Toolbox. I'm Andrew.
And I'm Angela.
And we are two farm cousins born and raised in Idaho, and we are also classically trained musicians. And Angela, what is this podcast about?
The aim of this podcast is that we can help people that want to have a career in music have tools necessary to do that. I know that when I got started in music, my idea of what a career musician looked like wasn't what it actually looks like, at least what it ended up looking like for me. So that's the aim of this podcast, is to get tools to be a more successful musician.
Yes, it is. And in today's episode, it's going to be a little bit different. We realized that we've done all these episodes. We've done 27 episodes, and we haven't really introduced who we are. And so we're going to be talking. I'm going to be interviewing Angela, and she's going to be interviewing me, so that you know why, or you know our background and you know who we are, so there's kind of more of a connection there. I think it's time for us to learn a little bit more about my cousin Angela. And there might be a few gaps because I know her so well. I'm not quite sure what to ask her, but I did write down a few questions. So I guess, Angela, tell us how you got started with music.
So in retrospect, having done what I've done with my career and taught as many students as I've taught, I now understand that my introduction to music and the way that I learned music is one of the most organic ways that one can learn music, or any language rather. Victor Wooten talks about this a lot, of how it wasn't that I believe, if I'm remembering right, what he said, it wasn't ever like you have to go practice or we're going to go learn an instrument. It was, let's go jam together with a family. And I wouldn't say that our family jammed together a lot, but the fact that I grew up listening to 20 or 30 students every week playing through their scales on piano, because my mother was a piano teacher, and then listening to my older siblings practice. I'm the youngest of five.
I am also the youngest. We didn't really.
Babies.
Yeah.
Listening to them practice their various instruments, singing in our family choir, singing at church. When I was really young, I actually sang to communicate with people a lot more than I actually spoke.
Interesting.
They weren't songs that were any song of any type. It was just, I would just sing what I was saying. So that's like the baseline foundation. And you don't understand how important that is until you, you kind of get slapped in the face like I did with a bunch of students. And I'm like, why don't you understand that after do comes re? Like, why can't you hear that? Right. So that was my very, very basic foundation. And then when I was four, my mother, who is a pianist, wanted to try a Yamaha group class piano course. And so I remember, I have very fond memories of being in a classroom with a very socially motivated individual.
You and
I
me both.
Like receiving praise, or at least I did as a child. It makes me quite uncomfortable now. But when I was young, I think I was so hungry for attention because I felt like it was in so many other places that I would do anything to get the gold star or the candy bar. Very easy to please me as a child. So I have very fond memories of being in a classroom with, I don't know, 9 or 12 beginning 4 or 5 year old piano students. Bless my mother's soul. is not my favorite age to teach. And we played a little bit of piano, and we did a lot of marching around, and we sang a lot of solfege and played a lot of games. And I actually used all of those skills when I was taking my, you know, first and second and third semester of sight singing in my music degree and bachelor's degree. That's how foundational the solfege was. which who knew, right?
Mm-hmm. That's, so I just have to take a quick side note. I think I didn't know that. I didn't know that you did solfege when you were four. That's crazy to me because I didn't start doing it until last year.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, and it was, I believe when I did my undergraduate, they did movable do. Mm. And I know that we did fixed do because it really, really confused me. Mm. But now I'm glad I have
both.
I'm ambidextrous that way. Mm-hmm. But that's how foundational it was for me because it was so confusing to me that you wanted me to move do around.
Why would you do that?
Middle C is do. Come on.
Yeah, obviously.
So, so I took piano there and then, I think it's funny because my mom and I have very different memories of this, but I was under the impression that, cause I did take private lessons on piano with her for a while. But I was under the impression that we just never got inconsistent lessons because I was her daughter. And so it was just like, you know, there's not a paycheck associated with this and, or, you know, it just didn't fit in the week this week kind of thing. And so I felt like that happened for a couple years. And then we just decided that grandma was going to teach me because she would make out a slot for me. Mm-hmm. And as far as I remember, that was where the break took place. Like, I don't remember going back and sitting with my mother. Mm-hmm. She doesn't remember it quite that way. So she's probably right. I know I was a whole 6 or 7 years old. So
your memory must be perfect, right?
Right. That's my memory. The other thing that I did when I was young, and I didn't find out about this until years later, but when I got good enough to play pieces like Malaganya and that kind of thing. So I think I was like 9 or 10.
On the piano.
There's different versions of
Malaganya. Okay. Okay. Yeah.
Anyway, but this was one that I would say is like an intermediate piece. Uh-huh. I don't remember who it's by because I haven't like practiced piano for 15 years. Yeah. But my mom was having me go through her music and I'm looking at I kid you not, piece after piece. Mm-hmm. And there's just scribbles in red pencil all over the place and stickers. And I'm like, Mom, what is this? And she's like, well, when you were little, and I do remember doing this, after she'd get done teaching, I'd go in where the piano was and I'd get out her music. And my mom's like, at this point, I don't think she does this anymore. You can correct me if I'm wrong. But when I was young, if you made a mistake, it got marked with a red pencil, right?
Uh-huh.
She doesn't do that anymore, right? Maybe sometimes.
At least when I first started, she would.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it was horrifying to me, right? Because I think grandma did the same thing.
Yeah.
So I would pick up her red pencil and I would pretend teaching piano to my imaginary friend. And I'd be like, no, this is wrong. And I'd be scribbling all over it because apparently my friend had not practiced because I heard a lot of that.
Wasn't getting your 40 hours in.
Yeah. I heard a lot of, you need to play this slower and you're not practicing this enough. And you know, that's, you know, from my young age, that's what I heard from the other room. And so that's what I did. And then at the end of the lesson, good job. And I just like cover it with stickers because you had your lesson and now you get stickers. Uh-huh. So I think that my earliest memories of what I wanted to be when I grew up was a piano teacher because that's what my mom.
So was. Just a quick question.
Yeah.
Did you give your imaginary friend candy bars?
Well, I didn't have any to give.
Oh, okay.
So I had no control of the treasure box or the prize box or whatever that was. It was very well hidden in our house with reason.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was limited to pencils and stickers, red pencil and stickers. Yeah. But yeah, so that was probably like how I got started in music. And then I have 3 degrees in viola and I played, in my view, I played pretty equally viola, which I started in 5th grade and piano all the way until I graduated high school.
Okay.
I took voice lessons for a couple years and I played cello in the high school orchestra for a couple years just to keep me from getting bored because not because I'm a prodigy or anything, but in school orchestra, viola parts are horrifically simplified.
Yeah.
And so I just needed something that was a challenge. So I played some cello, a little bit of violin. Once I played the solo part to a double violin concerto.
The Bach? That was
Vivaldi Christmas Concerto. Oh, okay. That was my only violin I ever played. I chose the viola. Unlike many violists who just love the sound of the viola, which I really wish I had that beautiful story, but I don't. mine was much more a need for autonomy in our family. Everybody played an instrument, and everyone, in my view, everyone played piano. Now I realize that wasn't true, but I think everyone started piano at some point.
Yeah.
And so in my young mind, everyone played piano, and then we all got to choose our own instrument when it came into the school music programs.
Okay.
My brother had chosen bass, and my sister had chosen cello, and my mother had played violin her whole life. And so the only instrument was viola that was left, because band didn't start until you were older. So that's why I chose the viola. And I started on the viola. I'm a viola purist. And yeah, that's how I got started in music.
Okay. Nice. So where did that, I'm curious, where did that lead you? Because you started with viola, you got to high school, and I know that you went to college, and then your plans kind of changed. So where did your beginnings of music get you to where you are now?
So I know that it seems like, from what you know of me, and probably what most people know of me, is that there's a lot of assumptions about how I feel about classical music. And the reality is that I've always felt like an outsider in the classical music world, partially because of my farm upbringing. You don't really associate a country bumpkin with a refined classical palette in general. Partially because I was always a very committed athlete. Whether or not I was a good athlete or not is another question. But I've always been very interested in sports and sports medicine and physical therapy, and I've always really loved challenging myself physically. And like my senior year of high school, before my senior year, the summer before that, I moved to Utah with my aunt to swim 5 hours a day with.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I did.
That's cool.
Because I wanted to go to state, and everybody that was really good at swimming had started swimming when they were five, just like they start playing violin when they're five if they want to be really good. And I didn't start until I was a ninth grader. So I went to Utah.
I went to Utah with the same aunt for a week, and I did it 1 hour a day. Swimming. Yeah. It was for my scout merit badge.
So I spent.
You spent 5 hours a day?
We were in the pool. So we were at the pool at 4:45 and we did an hour of dry land, and then we did 2 hours of swimming. And then I would teach swimming lessons and coach swim team for another 6 to 8 hours.
I had no idea.
The day. Yeah. And then we'd get back in the pool from 4 to 6 and do another workout.
Whoa.
And that was my summer. That's and it worked. Fun. I came back, and
that is so cool.
Our first week back in the water, I remember, I mean, and mind you, we had a couple guys on our team that were podium winners in their individual events. We got back in the pool, and we were supposed to kick a 500, and I beat every single one of them.
Wow.
So they were a little out of shape, and I'd worked hard all summer, but, so it's just, I've always, definitely had this like feeling of being an imposter, in music, because I was equally, if not a little bit more dedicated to all the other things, and possibly because music came so easily to me. And I don't mean that in a way, because again, like I said, I'm not a prodigy. I have plenty of faults in my musicianship. But I also think that there's just this really important mind-body connection for me. And I get that from doing physical things, which is why I like farm work, and why I like shoveling ditch and setting siphon tubes and walking out in the fields and chasing cows. And doing sports. So for me, a couple really big decisions that I felt like I made when I started my undergraduate degree was if I was going to do music. And I just assumed that I wasn't good enough to get into the music program where I wanted to go to school, because I knew how competitive the school was. They had five orchestras and two touring orchestras and five or six choirs, and three of them tour, and you know, you name it, they have it. It's really, really big music program. And so I applied, and we found out afterwards that they hadn't updated their website. And so the application deadlines were wrong. And we actually, my sister and I applied at the same time. She was going to be a transfer student. I was going to be a freshman. And we were past the deadline, which means people had already heard auditions and had already chosen their studios.
Yeah.
And I was just doing it to have the experience. Mm. And I was certain that I would do the same thing that all of my siblings had done, which was go to the College of Southern Idaho for 2 years because that's where my mother taught. And I had every scholarship you could think of, academic and music. Mm-hmm. And I also had free tuition mm-hmm. because she was a professor there. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I was just applying for the experience. Interesting. And then I ended up being accepted. Mm-hmm. And so I took that as a sign that I needed to go. Mm-hmm. So I went, and it was a really horrific experience my freshman year. Mm. The whole, like I say, imposter syndrome was even worse because I was the worst in the studio, like unquestionably the worst. My viola lessons, I never had a consistent viola teacher after my aunt moved, which I think I was in sixth grade, mm-hmm. because we had to drive 2.5 hours
to get four lessons. Yeah.
So we only did that every other week, because that's a big commitment. Mm-hmm. And I had a lot of holes technically. Mm-hmm. I would say that I'm a very intuitive musician. Mm-hmm. I'm not a very technical musician. Mm-hmm. I'm much better at it now because of my graduate teacher. Mm-hmm. So anyway, so even when I was at BYU, I felt like I needed an outlet that was not classical. And so I got a fiddle teacher. While I was there, he now has one of the only fiddle professorships in the entire country, mm-hmm. in Kentucky, I believe.
Wow.
Nate Olson. Mm-hmm. That man changed my life.
Wow.
Not because I was a good fiddle student. I was a mm-hmm. terrible fiddle student because I had this idea that fiddle music was easy. One of the dumbest things I've ever thought. Like in any genre of music, mm-hmm. if you really take it seriously and play it well, it is equally as virtuosic. It's really? Just oh yeah. Hmm. Oh yeah. Hmm. It's like taking all the romantic languages and saying, well, English is easier to learn than Spanish.
Yeah.
Why is it easier to learn?
Yeah.
Because that's not true. Mm-hmm. I think once you learn one, it's much easier to apply. Like I don't have to relearn what open D is on the violin.
Yeah.
But I sure have to relearn the accent.
Yeah.
And the way that you speak it and the way that you learn it.
Yeah.
So, and I specifically say romantic languages because I don't think it would be a fair comparison to compare it to Russian or Chinese, yeah. right? Mm-hmm. But I think that, you know, once you have a proficiency on an instrument, it's the same as like speaking one romantic language and then adding on a second or a third when yeah. you go to a different genre. Mm-hmm. So I got involved because BYU also has a touring folk dance group mm-hmm. and they have a live band that plays with them. And so I got involved with doing that with Mark Gesleson and Nate Olson. And I, like I said, was a terrible fiddle student, but I had a really great time playing in the ensembles there. And in one of the ensembles I was in, our drummer was like, hey, do you want to come join my brother's band? We're forming a band. And I was like, really? You want me in your band? Mm-hmm. I'm really bad at this. And he was like, no, come over. So every Thursday night, we'd go over to Aaron and Colin's house. And they were very, very, very good. He was a very good line snare drummer. Mm-hmm. And Colin was a very good bagpiper, Irish bagpiper. I hope I'm saying that right. Yeah. He's probably going to kill me if I say that. but we'd go over there every Thursday night and we'd have donuts and orange juice and make music. And my first rehearsal there, I walked in and Colin picks up his little tin whistle because he also played tin whistle. And he said, okay, so here's how it goes. And he starts playing and I'm like, where is the music?
Yeah. Or is it sheet music?
What are you doing?
Yeah.
And he was just like, oh, just listen to it. And I was like,
ah. Good joke.
And I have so much gratitude for them because they set me on such a different path, and I still consider them like some of my best friends, even though we talk very rarely, if at all. Just because there was so much, again, that organic way of making and creating music. And I believe that that's where I started like thinking of writing music and creating music, which I think is the most enjoyable thing that I do musically.
Well, it's really, I have to say for our listeners, I've listened to a lot of your music and it is so refreshing and so new. And hopefully someday you'll have something, because you don't, do you have anything out online? Well, no. I guess you have Silent Night.
I have a couple things on a YouTube channel, but I don't have an album.
But it is so refreshing to listen to your music. So you are a fantastic composer.
Thank you.
And she actually wrote the theme music for the podcast.
I did.
So
I did.
Yeah.
So but I never took any composition courses. And certainly when I was playing in that band, we were called the Flying Nancies.
That's a good name.
Yeah, it was a really funny name. It was a very eclectic band because we all kind of had this Irish folk type influence. But they also listened to like Breaking Benjamin, and we did covers of that, and it was just Sweet Home Alabama. I mean, and like everyone in the band, we played two or three instruments. So there was this really great ability to create something so different with each song.
That's cool.
And it just gave a lot of freedom. So anyway, knowing that, it probably changes your perspective of like what I consider myself musically. But I think the reason that I got to where I did with 3 degrees in classical viola performance is because I didn't realize that there were other ways to pursue music.
Okay.
I don't have any regrets about the education that I've achieved, in the sense that I learned from it. I would not be the violist that I am today without the fantastic mentorship that I have. And without all the people that were put in my path that way. I do wish that I had understood how vast the music industry is, and that there's more than one way to get to where you want to go. Meaning a degree doesn't always guarantee your pathway. And the lack of it does not condemn it. The reason I say that is because another thing that happened when I was in grad school is I got turned on to ethnomusicology, which is the ethnology of music, or
the origins.
No, not the origins. It's more about the experience of music. So if you've heard of anthropology, which goes and studies cultures, ethnomusicology is the anthropology of music.
Okay.
So like one of my professors at UC Santa Barbara, his whole study was on music from the Polish Tatras, which is a very specific region in Poland that has a very different type of music than the rest of the country. And he has written multiple books studying and transcribing and doing all of that.
That's cool.
Doctorate in research is about.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really turned on to that going back to our roots with our family, because I realized how tied my experience of music was to the anthropology in which I'd been raised in. So that was really interesting to me and kind of influenced what I decided to research when I was doing my document for my dissertation. But do I think that knowing those things about ethnomusicology makes me a better violist? Definitely not directly. Could I have gotten to the same level of playing without that degree, but playing with the same teacher? Probably, if she'd been willing to teach me.
Yeah.
And I think she would have, to be perfectly honest. So those are just some things about my degree. But I'm very grateful that I had all the help that I did to go and get my education and for the mentors that have been put in my life, in the various different, whether it was my undergraduate or graduate degree, I've always had mentors that have gone to bat for me, whether it was a financial thing or an emotional issue I was having or whatever. The other driving force, I would say, behind me feeling like I really needed an education, is that I watched my mom going back to school in my childhood. She went back to get a master's degree while I was growing up. And I really didn't want to have that need in my life later down the road when I had a family. I wanted to have that stone in place if I had any control over that. So those are all the things that kind of influenced me toward what I did. Yeah.
That's great. You actually kind of answered a lot of my future questions. However, I am a little, I want to ask a question about how, well, what you learned about yourself and how you kind of got through that imposter syndrome and what you learned about through through those years.
Well, I'm a terrible person to ask that because so how I got over the imposter syndrome, I just stopped caring, to be perfectly honest. I stopped caring what other people thought, and I've had different which is, I wouldn't say is always the best thing.
Yeah,
because you need to care what your mentor has to say.
Yeah.
And I always took to heart when I had mentors in my life and I listened to them. But at some point, you have to become your own musician.
Yeah.
I would not advise doing that when you're a student.
Yeah.
I would strongly advise learning everything that you can and soaking up everything that you can from every teacher that you can. But once you've done that, have the confidence to go out and make decisions for yourself.
Okay.
Just like when you leave home, you've had your parents there holding your hand and helping you,
fixing you dinner,
doing, you know, washing your clothes, telling you to clean your room. And at some point you have to break away and decide what kind of adult you're going to be. So I think that's really important. And the graduate teacher that I studied with, Helen Callis, she was really great about, helping us find a balance between having her as a mentor, but also understanding and finding what our individual voice was and what that specific space in the industry was, so that we had a unique aspect to offer to the classical music world.
Okay.
So, so that's one thing, is I just stopped caring, but that goes into a whole other part of my life that has nothing to do with music. Because, one of the reasons I went and studied with Professor Callis is I had horrific stage fright when I was doing my undergrad.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Especially for solo stuff. And in my eyes, Helen Callis was one of the best solo performers in the country, if not internationally. And so I thought, well, if I really do want to get better at this, I should go study with the best. And what it came down to is that while you can do things to specifically focus on getting better at performing, for me, there were other parts of myself as a human that needed to develop and be challenged in order to get over that stage fright. And then the other thing that I realized is the reason I had stage fright is because I wasn't playing music that I really, truly cared about. And the stuff that I really, truly care about is the stuff that I write.
Really?
Yes. I do not get nervous when I perform my own music.
Interesting.
Honestly, I don't. I have no nerves whatsoever.
Wow.
No matter how hard it is. No problem.
Wow.
So that was something that I would not have discovered had I had a different mentor that did not encourage me toward that path of discovery. The other thing that I did, there are two things. One was I did a lot of emotional work, to work through things like depression. I don't think I ever had, I did have anxiety. I had some points in my life where I definitely had some anxiety attacks. And, I remember one day realizing that the agony that I was living, or the unhappiness that I had in my life was all by my own choice and how stupid that was. Mm-hmm. And it was like one of those ding moments. And you're like, why am I choosing to be unhappy? Mm-hmm. Why? And most of us do this to ourselves. Yeah. We choose our own unhappiness, mm-hmm. whether it's because we haven't really thought out what mm-hmm. we want, or we don't know what we want. Mm-hmm. And it's okay to not know. Mm-hmm. That's, you go through different paths and you figure it out that way. But, or we're like challenged by the constructs of our social environment.
I was just right? gonna bring that up.
So combination of all those things. Mm-hmm. And I had a really horrific experience, which I'm sure you can relate to a little bit, because mm-hmm. one of the events of five mm-hmm. led to the worst depression I've had in my life. And I had, our grandmother passed away and mm-hmm. we had a cousin that died, and I was in California. I felt very moved. I was in a very toxic musical environment that was associated with my stipend, the way that my schooling was being paid. Mm-hmm. Very, very toxic, lots of fighting. And I had to meet with these people every day. And then I had a lot of pressures in my religious environment. Mm. And I'd just gotten out of a relationship that I'd been in for longer than it should have been in. And all of those things happened within about 6 months. And all of those are triggers of having serious depression. Mm-hmm. And so finally I realized like, I need to like simplify my life. Mm-hmm. And I had a friend who'd worked with a therapist in Denmark. And she just happened to be in my life at the time and suggested, you might want to go check this out. Mm. And one thing that I really wanted to try before other avenues, and I have no problem with mental illness and medication. I think then a lot of times it's necessary. For me, because it was a situational depression, I really wanted to try to balance it with life, like coping skills, meaning like diet, exercise, talk therapy, before I resorted to medication. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's always the right choice. Mm-hmm. But I did want to try it for myself.
Yeah.
So I started working with a therapist in the States. And then when school was out, I flew over to Denmark for a month and I took my bicycle. And if you've ever been to Denmark in the summer, they have Northern Lights, right? Mm. So the sun doesn't go down per se, or it doesn't actually get dark. The sun goes down, but it doesn't get dark. And so I would go on bike rides whenever I wanted to. And I spent, $3,500 in therapist fees, best $3,500 I've ever spent.
For sure.
I just rode hundreds of miles all over the Danish countryside and talked to a therapist. And I came back from that and I knew, the number one thing that was sticking in my head is I just spent $3,500 for someone to tell me that it's okay to be me, that there's nothing wrong with me. Mm-hmm. Cause I'd been apologizing for things that came very naturally and intuitively to me for most of my life. Mm. So that freedom made it so that I didn't care anymore. Mm-hmm. And so I slowly started planting these seeds where, I just didn't care enough anymore about the way that this trill is supposed to be played because of the manuscript, that I was willing to sacrifice my musical enjoyment for that.
Yeah.
And that qualifies the kinds of audiences you can play for. And I totally understand that, but I have no interest in going and playing for an international competition. So it really doesn't matter to me.
Yeah.
And the last thing that I did is before I was able to go and work with that therapist, I'd started cycling. Santa Barbara is a huge cycling community. Mm-hmm. And one day I went on a 50-mile bike ride.
Wow.
And I got back from that and I was just on this high for 3 or 4 days. And then I went on another one the next week. And that happened for about a month. And then 1 week I didn't go on it and I was so down. Mm. And I realized that whatever the chemical imbalance was in my body, it was balanced by doing one long ride on my bike. Mm-hmm. So I ended up getting really good at cycling, mm-hmm. and also managing my stress through mm-hmm. cycling, mm-hmm. which then led me to going and competing at a national level in cycling and triathlon mm-hmm. while I was doing my doctorate in music. So again,
mm-hmm. yeah,
there's the clash of the two worlds.
Yeah.
Go figure. Uh-huh. But that was very formative for me as well, because it gave me an opportunity to be in a high pressure situation and something that I didn't care about. Mm. So the same type of energy that I would feel on stage as a performer,
yeah.
where your heart's beating and you have to make these split second decisions and something happens that you're not ready to. I don't know if you know much about cycling, but if you get on a crit course and you make one wrong move, or someone else around you makes a wrong move, you've got 10 people on the floor and broken bones.
Yeah.
It's terrifying.
Yeah.
Like, it's really terrifying. Yeah. And so while it was slightly dangerous, it was amazing to me to see how successful I could be at something mm-hmm. when I didn't care about it.
Yeah.
And when I mean care about, of course I care about it, because yeah. I always have this high expectation of myself, but I didn't care about it in a way that my future
yeah.
mattered.
Yeah.
And so I would try to apply those same physical ways that I calmed my body down, even when I was in a high intensity situation, to when I was performing. And I got much better at mm-hmm. playing music by other composers
yeah.
through that experience. Hmm. So
that's an amazing experience. And you talking about that kind of, it made me realize that you guys might have the impression that I'm a musical nerd. But I've had a similar experience with just like with the health side mm-hmm. of just like maintaining a healthy way of living and just like, you know, exercising and being active. And I guess I just think it's so cool how you pointed out that you did something that you could be really good at, but there wasn't that pressure to be good at it.
And I could have turned it into that.
Yeah, you could. Yeah.
But I chose not to.
Yeah.
Because
then it would have.
Then it would have just added one more thing that was stressful to me in that way.
Yeah.
And I kind of appreciated walking into something that I knew nothing about.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And you're getting that balance of having not just music in your life and having different things kind of keeping you balanced.
And I know that cycling, for example, there was an actual chemical imbalance in my body, because in the last couple of years, I don't get the same high from riding mm-hmm. and I don't enjoy it the way that I used to.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Huh. So whatever hole was there has been filled. And I don't know if that's due to becoming a mother, having a husband, or uh-huh. a combination of all those things. I wish that I wanted to go out and do it the way that I did.
Yeah.
I really miss that freedom and that feeling of accomplishment when you've gone 100 miles or mm-hmm. 120 miles or just a really fast 20 mile ride or something. Mm-hmm. I loved it, and I do still love it, but not the same way. And it doesn't do the same thing to me physically or mentally that it used to. Mm. So it served its purpose.
Yeah. That's cool.
So anyway.
Well, Angela, I think that's a good place to wrap up our get to know you episode.
Hopefully you know us better now.
Yeah. And hopefully you'll learn more about us in the future through the next future episodes. And I don't know how you feel about this, but if there's anyone who really enjoyed this episode and wants to learn more about us, maybe we could
ask us some questions.
Yeah, send us some questions and we could do maybe a semi-regular Q&A conversation. I think that'd be fun.
Maybe a live.
Yeah, that would be fun. Well, I've learned something about you, even though I've known you for 19 years.
There we go.
So, well, thank you for listening, you guys. Yeah. And we'll see you in the next episode.
Sounds good. See you later.
What a great interview. Thank you so much for listening and watching. And we truly hope that you have found some tools to put in your toolbox.
Our podcast, as a reminder, can be found on various platforms as well as on YouTube.
Once again, feel free to send us a DM or a voice message with anything that you'd like to see in the future.
We often post announcements and upcoming guests on our social media, so if that's interesting to you, you should go and give us a follow.
Yeah, we would love some follows. And lastly, while we do love doing this for free, podcasting is not free. So if you really like what we're doing and have gained some value from our show, there are a few ways that you can support us.
You could share with your friends.
You could rate and review.
And subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
You could also shop our merch, which you might have seen in our YouTube videos, or become a supporter through a donation at the Anchor Podcast link in the show notes below.
Thanks for watching.
See you later.